Support for Radioactive comes from the members of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Ellsworth on the Bucksport Road, with Sunday services at 10:30 a.m., affirming and promoting respect for the interdependent web of existence and the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all.
It's 4 o'clock and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor, and streaming online at WERU.org. Radioactive is next.
This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Meredith DeFrancesco and Amy Brown for August 23rd, 2007. Today we'll be talking with Stuart True of the Council of Canadians about the so-called Security and Prosperity Partnership meeting this week with business CEOs and heads of state in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Earlier this week in Montebello, Canada, the heads of state of Canada, the U.S., and Mexico met in what is being called the Security and Prosperity Partnership, or SPP. Established 2 years ago, the Security and Prosperity Partnership has taken as its focus the further homogenization of corporate business goals and the integration of U.S. government security measures into Mexican and Canadian policies. At the table to work out the execution of such goals has been the richest North American corporations, who'd continue to push the agenda they set forth in the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. Less government regulation, lower taxes for business, privatization of resources and services, and free trade. The tri-government partnership, however, has been treated more as an agreement between those invited to the table and less about a wider democratic discourse on the contents or implications such a partnership would result in. In Canada, public opposition has been a lot more audible than in the U.S., perhaps due to the fact that much of what is discussed involves integrating into U.S. policy and energy demands. This week, as Presidents Calderon and Bush and Premier Harper met in Montebello, many unions, organizations, and others gathered to protest the SPP. There is now a recent development making Canadian headlines involving the use of agent provocateurs to open up the crowds to police crackdown. We have with us today Stuart True from the policy and advocacy organization, the Council of Canadians. They've been out front over the past years on many issues included or now touched on in the SPP, from trade and privatization to corporate domination of public policy. Welcome to the program, Stuart.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So why don't you educate us about what this partnership, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, is and how it came to be?
Sure, certainly. From what we can tell, first of all, it's not an agreement or a treaty in the traditional sense of the word. It is essentially a formal handshake, if you will, a gentleman's agreement that was come to in 2005 in March in Waco, Texas, between the governments of Canada, Mexico, and the United States. And it was basically in response to a fear among the business community, actually largely in Canada and in Mexico, less so in the United States, that after 9/11, when the borders closed with good reason because of the terrorist attacks on New York, there was a fear among the business community that, you know, that this could happen again, and that, you know, to avoid it at all costs, they were willing to enter into new negotiations between all three countries to kind of further integrate the country's economies and also kind of pull in security, U.S.-style homeland security desires for the continent, right? So this, basically the SPP was, idea for it was born close to 9/11, and since then there had been a heavy business push, especially in Canada, from an organization called the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, which essentially led up towards, in 2005, the creation of this SPP by our government.
Can you continue talking about then what some of the goals then are of the SPP or of the participants in this partnership, both concerning economic, and then we can go to the security?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you're seeing is the goals are twofold, I think. And the main goal was to kind of tie in security with the economy once and for all. And I think this was a means of kind of, just like NAFTA kind of pulled economic matters away from, potential political discussion. Right? Like, it became basically crazy to talk about economic models that were different than the free trade model being pushed, right? I think that the STP was a means of kind of taking the security paradigm that was being established by the Department of Homeland Security and making that unquestionable, right? So that was one of the goals. And so what you see is since 9/11, through agreements, at least between Canada and the United States, like the Smart Border Declaration, which was a major initiative, including 30 measures that would further integrate the Canadian and U.S. Security apparatuses, if you like, in terms of immigration policy, refugee policy, and kind of the harmonization with Patriot Act kind of security policies. You saw that kind of bringing that Smart Border Declaration, lumping it in with NAFTA priorities that never really took place, for instance, major regulatory harmonization in terms of agricultural, food, environmental, oil and gas standards, that kind of thing. And you saw them kind of lumped together in this new partnership that that also, as well as these kind of individual policies around integration and harmonization, I think is we think at the Council of Canadians, is involves quite a new vision for North America as a single trading bloc and a single kind of security zone, right? So it's kind of an agreement between all three countries to, in a sense, privilege the North American over the national in almost all aspects of policy, right? And this clearly has, I think, kind of asymmetrical consequences, right? Where in Canada and Mexico, the trend will be towards closer closer integration with the U.S. model, so as you said in the introduction. And I think that there's even foreign policy consequences that we're seeing, especially in Canada, as the kind of foreign policies of the three countries are tending to merge more and more these days also.
Now, we're saying this partnership is not policy specific, or rather it's not a free trade agreement that everyone's looking for the rubber stamp of their various governments. Can you talk about then where the power really lies and what's being discussed and decided upon in this partnership, and how then the goals that are decided upon, are they implemented as this is the partnership's considered sort of a powerful lobby group? What is their connection in to try to get some of these things implemented into policy?
Yeah, well, from the beginning, from 2005, in the initial kind of in the launch of the STP, they described the decision-making process and how it would proceed would be meetings with business, roundtable discussions with stakeholders, whoever they are. They still haven't told anybody who these stakeholders were, and briefing sessions for Congress or Parliament. And so what we've seen since then is we've seen a lot of meetings with business. And in 2006, at the Cancun Summit, we saw the creation of this completely corporate body called the North American Competitiveness Council, which was a collection of the same companies that had been pushing for the Security and Prosperity Partnership since 9/11. It basically rounded them up and threw them onto a permanent advisory body to the Security and Prosperity Partnership and told them, you know, what should we do with this agreement? Where would you like to see it go? And we do have one quote from a CEO of Lockheed Martin, a company which sits on this North American Competitiveness Council. And the quote was, the direction from the leaders was, tell us what we need to do and we'll make it happen. So that gives you an idea of kind of who's really pulling the strings behind the SDP. And what we see at the Council of Canadians is it's a clear indication of whose interest this new partnership is working towards.
And do you feel that those policies they'd be integrating into will be creating new laws or making additions to laws or agreements already in the books?
Yeah, it's quite ingenious how they did it. Instead of kind of coming up with a new NAFTA, right, kind of a security version of NAFTA, they decided that everything they're going to do is going to be on a regulatory basis. And so they don't need to go through Congress and they don't need to go through Parliament. And what they've done is they've established, the leaders have established at least 20 working groups in all kinds of areas, transportation, food, security, immigration, that kind of thing. And these working groups have been, well, since 2005, kind of, making little tweaks in the rules in Canada, the United States, and Mexico that would bring them more in line and kind of work towards this this common security perimeter, common security zone, and common economic zone without actually having to take this plan to the public or the politicians in any of the three countries.
Sorry, are you still there?
Yep.
Okay, just a little connection problem. Let's tease out this a little bit more then with the economic homogeny. Some of the big points it seems to be is energy and also deregulation of certain environmental policies, among other things. And then we can go to security and look at sort of the concerns that would be there, especially if we're talking about integrating other countries into something like the Military Commissions Act. Can you first talk a little bit about energy and deregulation under the economics?
Sure. The energy one we think is crucial to the SPP, and I don't think you would have seen a Security and Prosperity Partnership that didn't include energy integration as it's one of its main goals. Everyone I think knows that the United States is a big consumer of oil and gas, and that it is kind of actively seeking out new sources as its reserves go down. And one of those sources, and Canada, without, you know, not to sound like we don't want to sell oil and gas in the United States, Canada is very willing to. But one of the major sources is coming, is increasingly the Alberta tar sands. Now, this is a very environmentally disastrous way to create oil, basically. It requires between 3 and 5 barrels of clean water and a lot of natural gas to produce 1 barrel of oil from the tar sands. And so built into the SPP is kind of this push for a 5-fold increase in tar sands production out of Canada. And so you're going to see that there's going to be incredible environmental consequences, not the least of which is a massive increase in greenhouse gas emissions, which is one of the reasons why California's Arnold Schwarzenegger has decided not to buy any oil coming out of the tar sands because of the huge impact it has on the environment. So, I mean, while the Canadian-American energy sectors are by and large integrated already, there are interesting developments within the SPP and pushes from the private sector, especially in the United States, to privatize Mexico's oil and gas sector. This is one of the main recommendations of the North American Competitiveness Council. So you can see that energy is a big focus. In terms of other economic aspects of the SPP, is this actually just yesterday, the three governments released a North American Regulatory Cooperation Framework. And this is essentially the regulatory harmonization that they've been trying to get serious with since NAFTA. Our concerns over this is that in the United States and Canada, there is a move towards deregulation and towards kind of letting industries regulate themselves. I guess specifically in the United States, end of July, Bush signed an executive order that kind of centralizes the authority over regulation through various agencies into the White House. So if the EPA were to, wanted to create some new regulation, they would actually have to pass it through the White House, through this new agency, which has a mandate to require that these agencies look at whether there is a market-friendly solution before they regulate, right? So the move in all, and it's the same in Canada, we've had this push for what they call smart regulation. Since the SPP came into effect in 2005, our government has been coming up with a new way to regulate industry, which actually brings industry in at the early phases and tries to work out market solutions instead of actually kind of thinking first about the public interest, right? So,
and what kind of laws are we looking at here in the realm of labor, environment, health? What sort of laws are opened up specifically or that they're interested in?
Well, recently in Canada, We had a report that in the area of pesticide residues on foods, that because of the SPP, Canada would be increasing the amount of pesticide residues it allows on hundreds of fruits and vegetables coming from the United States. This is not to say that our regulations on food are that much, if at all, stricter than those in the United States. In fact, I believe in many cases, U.S., at least as many cases, U.S. regulations on pesticides, for instance, are stricter. But this made a big splash in Canada because it was proof that the goal of the SPP wasn't necessarily to create a common strict standard on something like pesticides. It was, in fact, to move downwards and to kind of loosen them in that sense. So that was one area where clearly it doesn't make sense. Regulatory harmonization doesn't make sense.
Other points in particular under the economics before we move on to security? I know there's a lot under each one, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you're seeing, too, is a common approach now to the environment, and especially when it comes to Kyoto. Canada had originally signed the Kyoto Agreement, and although we have done absolutely squat to actually meet our requirements, what's happening now is you're getting a common approach between Bush and Harper towards the environment, the kind of environmental steps that should be taken to solve the greenhouse gas problem. So you don't see kind of renewable energy being put into the SPP. You see things like more oil sands production. You see nuclear power, and you see kind of relying very heavily on things like ethanol, right? Which isn't going to solve any problem with the amount of agricultural space you need for the corn to grow in order to fuel this. So you see kind of the SPP, I think, puts very strict limits on what we can do as countries to protect the environment, and I think that you know, falls under the economic side of things, I believe.
And with security, let's talk about the homogenization that we're looking at to sort of integrate Canada and Mexico into current policies that the United States is embarking on in their so-called war on terror, particularly around the Military Commissions Act, and what those requests are. I know that there's concern that Canada hasn't been standing up enough on particular cases involving Canadian citizens. And can you talk about how this might be indicative of the sort of things that are being discussed under the Security and Prosperity mm-hmm. Partnership?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of the SPP comes out of that fear among the Department of Homeland Security that Canada wasn't doing enough somehow to protect Canadians or Americans from terrorism. And so there has been this broad, the SAP includes broad plans to kind of, adopt the same mentality as the Homeland Security has, and to kind of the same in terms of refugee policies, in terms of who is considered or not considered a risk, how those people are graded, who can fly and who can't, in terms of joint no-fly lists and stuff like that. And, we've had in Canada a very high-profile case and proof, I think, that this is not necessarily a good thing, this kind of integration, was the case of Maher Arar. And I'm not sure how much you know about it, but he was a Canadian citizen who was actually taken by U.S. officials in New York in 2002. He was detained, he was questioned, and then eventually he was rendered to Syria, where he was spent a year in prison and was tortured before coming back to Canada when the Syrians said there's basically, we have nothing on him. You know, there's no case against him. And Maher Arar pushed this, and he eventually got a public inquiry into his rendition. And it turns out that the final results of this are out. It was because of kind of unfiltered sharing of information directly between the RCMP and the Department of Homeland Security and other agency story like the CIA that actually led to his deportation. And it was this fear among Canadian security institutions that they had to produce something, right? They had to produce some evidence to show the United States that we were getting serious. And the result was that an innocent person was rendered, just to kind of show that we're part of the game. And so more frequently in terms of no-fly lists, I mean, this Maher Arar is actually still on the U.S. no-fly list, even though our government and our RCMP have actually publicly apologized and exonerated him of all wrongdoing. So we don't see this as necessarily in the interests of Canadians, and for that matter, I mean, of Americans or Mexicans, but these intensely, I think, paranoid homeland security policies.
And as you understand it, what then is the SPP's, what are they demanding of its participants regarding security?
Well, it's essentially...
It's being worked out still.
Yeah, it's across the board, it's across the board harmonization of most security measures in terms of what individuals you let in or don't let into to North America, essentially, whether tourists or immigrants or refugees. it's basically a common mentality on who is a valuable new citizen, or who is who we should let into North America and who we shouldn't, and the reasons why we shouldn't let these people in. So, for instance, if the United States automatically considers Muslim men from 25 countries at higher risk than anybody else, then necessarily the integration would require Canada to consider the same policies, right? So essentially it's to create a fortress North America is what we said, where nobody's really considered innocent inside or outside the North America. It's all a matter of certain degrees of risk that the people actually, as we've seen in Canada and the United States, you don't have the power to challenge your risk. You're just basically allotted a risk score, and that's the end of the story.
Let's move on to the meetings that are going on right now, if we can, in the next 5 minutes we have in the program. From the 19th to the 21st, Presidents Calderon, Bush, and Premier Harper have been meeting in Montebello, Canada, specifically around this security and prosperity partnership. Can you talk about what's been going on there, what you understand has been happening in the meetings, and then also the massive demonstrations that have been happening and some of the disturbing things that have been brought to light in the Agent Provocateur case?
Right. Well, we don't know exactly. I mean, we have statements of what they talked about, and they have come out with several new joint policies, basically, one on pandemic preparedness, which I'm currently reading through, one on regulatory harmonization, one on common intellectual property regime. And so these are the kind of concrete things we've seen come out of the meeting. We also had hunches that they might be talking about bulk water exports from Canada to the United States. This is based on meetings that have been going on in the past year linked to the SPP that have been talking about water. But as with the other meetings, we don't know exactly what they were talking about because they are behind closed doors. They surround these things with a massive security. I mean, there was around Montebello, the hotel there, there was a 3-meter fence with barbed wire at the top. And I don't know how many security officials from the United States and Canada, they brought up police officers from Toronto, Montreal, and Ottawa just to protect this thing.
And meeting there were, again, these heads of states and other government officials, we assume,
and
the
business,
CEO.
Yeah.
Business lobbies.
That's
or
right. Yes.
Business heads.
The North American Competitiveness Council were there again, actually renewing their push to be actually even more involved. They seem to be calling for even more power through this process. They want the NACC institutionalized, and they want to see quicker progress on some of their recommendations. So the Council of Canadians and other groups like the Canadian Labour Congress, several unions, and a lot of grassroots organizations had mobilized around this summit. We were there outside, I think between 2,000 and 3,000 people protesting. The council had 10,000 petitions that we had gathered from our members and from others across Canada to deliver to the leaders saying that we don't agree with this undemocratic process and that we'd like to see it opened up to debate and public debate. And what we found, a video actually that was caught by a Council of Canadians chapter member showed what was pretty clear evidence of the presence of agent provocateur within the crowd. You can see the video on YouTube or on the Council of Canadians website at www.canadians.org. But essentially, it created a bit of a firestorm in the media, which still hasn't died down as people are trying to figure out who these three men were that were apparently arrested but actually didn't show up on the arrest records. So there's a lot of calls now for kind of an investigation, if it goes that way, or at least some kind of explanation from our public safety minister and our prime minister as to why they felt the need to insert rock-wielding fake protesters into a legitimate, fairly peaceful protest in what we think is an attempt to kind of either justify the massive security they paid for or to kind of stir up some police response to crack down on the protest.
Mm-hmm. Which is not uncommon, but what is uncommon is the perhaps catching it on video and
yes,
the response that the Canadian media, again, the U.S. media, is not necessarily responsive when we find those own things in our demonstrations here.
And we'll put that YouTube link up on our website as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Other things in the next couple of minutes concerning the SPP this week of talks and the SPP's ongoing role, as you understand it, in policy. Have they just considered themselves an ongoing body of thought?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you're going to see, based on I think heavy calls from the opposition parties here in Canada for a public debate on the SPP. We hadn't seen this before, but because of public pressure, we have all four, actually, opposition parties here now calling for more openness and some kind of legislative debate, which was actually never supposed to happen. If you look at the SPP materials, it's supposed to be an executive process. Everyone loves it, that kind of thing. But I think what you're going to see is you are going to see the leaders of all three countries, I hope, having to account for these legitimate concerns that the SPP is taking the continent as a whole in a direction that a lot of the people within each country wouldn't agree with, namely because it doesn't include, the SPP does not include environmental concerns about greenhouse gas emissions and the destruction of the environment and energy. It doesn't include labor concerns, essentially. Essentially, it's a way to kind of fortify the current labor patterns in North America, which are quite uneven, unequal, and relying on cheap labor outside of North America.
And quickly, we really do have half a minute.
Sure.
One, your contact information, and I'd be interested about a quick comment on the lack of, you feel, U.S. organizations being appraised of and acting on this issue.
Sure. Well, yeah, in the United States, the opposition to the SPP has come mainly from what you might call the extreme right, very anti-immigration, very protectionist, and they're basically surrounded. They've been lobbying towards Lou Dobbs. He's been talking about it on CNN. But basically, I think that what needs to happen in the United States, if I can say that, coming from Canada, is that we do need a strong liberal or left-wing attack on this SPP, because there are it should be of enormous concern, I think, to all Americans, not just these people who don't want to see more Mexicans in the country. I don't think that's the spirit of our attack on the SPP at all. If you want more information about the Council of Canadians' position on the SPP, you can go to www.canadians.org or www.integratethis.org, which was set up specifically to fight the Security and Prosperity Partnership.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us today and informing us about this issue. Stuart True with the Council of Canadians.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
And we will put that contact information on the WERU website, along with the audio archive, excuse me, of today's program that will be at weru.org tomorrow morning. Before we closed, we wanted to let you know about a peace rally in March that will be taking place this weekend in Kennebunkport. There will be camping and a concert on Friday night. And on Saturday, there will be more music and speakers, including, we have a list here that was given to us from the organizers, Cindy Sheehan, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, Melinda and Carlos Arredondo. There's going to be music by the Indigo Girls, Anana, David Rovix, Pat Scanlon and Band, and many, many others. If you would like more information about camping on both nights, as well as the march, the rally, and the concerts that will be taking place on Friday night, you can go to kportprotest.org. That's kportprotest.org. And you've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Meredith DeFrancesco and Amy Brown. Please join us again next Thursday at 4 for Radioactive. In the meantime, check out our archived programs at weru.org. And if you'd like to get in touch with us with a story idea or any comments, you can email news@weru.org and put Radioactive in the subject line. Thanks for listening and acting.
Radioactive is made possible in part by Artisan Builders, providing environmental design, construction, and renovation for homeowners and local businesses since 1992. 525-7740.